That you are doing okay. I am your radio neighbor, and I do what neighbors do. When you're not around, we are the neighbors that sit around to know what's happening, and now I'm giving you the gists as we see them in Nigeria. But at this point, I would be taking a break from the news stories in Nigeria to talk with my guest. Of course, I've been telling you I'll be having a discussion with my guest as regards the issues of the AU Day that was celebrated yesterday, the 9th of September. The AU Day was about the accomplishments of the AU, and particularly as regards the issue of bringing lasting peace to the African continent. And the theme for this year's celebration was, of course, silencing the guns, and of course, it as part of owning the future. And I have with me to discuss this here, Dr. Olawale Ismail, who has over 13 years experience of carrying out research on security and peace building issues. He's the substantive head of research at the International ALAT. He's a PhD in peace studies from the University of Bradford and an MPhil in international relations from the University of Cambridge. Of course, I can go on and on. He has so much, even bespoke consultancy services to reputable development cooperation agencies and intergovernment bodies, including the Department of International Development, Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, Royal Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, European Union, African Union, ECOWAS, Southern African Development, and so forth and so on. I'm talking about a seasoned Nigerian researcher who is all the way in another country. I don't want to mention, probably we'll hear that from him. Okay, so Dr. Ismail, are you there with me on the show?
Yes, I am, yes.
Okay, thank you for joining us on the show. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good.
Okay, so let's run along with the questions. Africa, or AU, has been planning to create lasting peace, because that is what is needed for the development and economic blossoming of the continent. First of all, let me hear what you think about how far they have achieved that, since, of course, they had this program 6 years ago projecting 2020 as a time when they would have ended all forms of insecurities as they could. Now, do you think, or how would you rate their performance as an AU, as a continental bloc that is aiming to bring peace to the continent? How far have they fared?
Yes, thank you for this opportunity. It's always a pleasure to be able to share one's thought and perspective on issues relating to peace and security in Africa. There are as an academic on the one hand, but also as an African on the other. It is, you know, peace and security challenges are so dear to my work, to my existence, in addition to Africa. Can I just update my profile that you mentioned earlier on?
Okay, sir.
I have since joined King's College London as a senior research fellow, senior lecturer in leadership, peace and development over the past 2 years. So I've been at King's.
Okay.
But every other details is fine.
Okay.
Yes, coming back to your question, the debate about how well as the African Union or even African institutions broadly defined, how well they've done in respect of finding solutions to recurring cases of conflict, conflict in Africa, conflict with labs, and even low intensity conflict. Nowadays, we call them gray zone warfare. They are not a full war, but they are, you know, it is a no war, no peace situation. I think it depends on what criteria and what perspective that, you know, we are looking at. For instance, if you are talking about headline conflict, big, you know, big arm conflict, such as the ones in South Sudan, such as the one in Darfur in Sudan, such as Somalia, such as the conflict in Mali, such as the political crisis in Guinea-Bissau, such as instability in Togo because of, you know, recurring protests over the last 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
You would want to say that the AU has been engaging in this. It's, you know, they've been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes preventive diplomacy through the activities of the Panel of the Wise, use of respected elder states, men and women on the continent, being deployed as special envoys, as peace envoys, to help find solutions to this. The EU has been working quite closely with regional economic communities. In the case of West Africa, the EU has been working with ECOWAS on the one hand, as well as the UN Office for West Africa and Sahel, you know us. So they are plugged in on some of those major headline armed conflict on the continent. So I would say that the AU is doing reasonably well as it could, because many of these conflicts are classical wicked problems that, you know, there are no solutions on the shelf. You don't just wake up and the conflicts vanish. But, you know, the most that any institution, even be it the UN or even the AU in this regard, the most that it can do is to stay engaged in the process, you know, speaking to the actors, seeking to exploit openings and opportunities for peace. So the AU is doing reasonably well as it could, given the nature of those conflicts and the history of those conflicts. Now, where I feel the AU is not doing well, has not done much, and probably doesn't have the tools as yet, does not yet have the capacity and the tools as yet to engage, to prevent, to put an end, what is called low intensity conflict. And the record of the AU on low intensity conflict, which by the way, will constitute the most challenge, you know, in Africa now, you know, the AU has not, or is not doing reasonably well in this. And I'll give you practical examples of what I mean by this. You look at the farmer, you look at the farmer elder crisis in central Nigeria, in north central part of Nigeria, now extending to banditry in the northwest part of Nigeria. You look at that, the AU and ECOWAS will ordinarily, would normally expect that these are issues internal to Nigeria. And in line with the Constitutive Act, the principles of, you know, by which the AU operates in the Constitutive Act, the AU will not interfere in this because of the principles of sovereignty and non, you know, political non-interference.
Okay.
But that for me is where the most people are dying, is where the most, you know, humanitarian crisis in terms of displacement is taking place across the whole continent. It's not just, I mean, that's just a typical example of Nigeria. Look at xenophobic violence in South Africa. Look at intercommunal clashes in central regions of Mali. Forget about the crisis, you know, in northern Mali. There is another layer, there are other layers of crisis in Mali. The crisis between communities, between Fulani, you know, and non-Fulani communities, between elders and farmers, farmer communities in north central, sorry, in the north central region of Mali. You go to the same intercommunal, you know, crisis in across the whole of Kenya. You have similar crises. You go to Eastern DRC. For how long has Eastern DRC been, you know, a lawless, you know, part of Africa? The UN is deployed there. The AU has been there. The EU has been there. But the insecurity is still there. You look at what is now happening, you know, along the coastal, you know, regions of Mozambique. Now you now have Islamic extremists now popping up in that. Even in Ghana, you have the same intercommunal clashes in Ghana. So it is this sort of low intensity below the threshold of a former war or a former armed conflict that the AU is actually, you know, is practically helpless. It doesn't have the toolbox, it doesn't have the capacity, it doesn't even know how to engage with this because it believes it's part of the internal affairs of member states. But where a member state lacks the capacity or is unable to deal with it, the AU doesn't possess the means to be able to engage in this sort of conflict.
Okay.
Those are where the guns are still booming loud in Africa, that if not, and I doubt if they will be able to silence the guns as yet in those kinds of conflicts. I will leave it at that.
Okay, let's talk about something a bit different. We'll get back to this. The AU generally has a plan called Agenda 2063. Since 1963, when it was formed as OAU, till when it celebrated 50 years in 2013, they said those first 50 years was a period of renaissance and identification of their identity as Africans, which might be part of what we're discussing. First of all, as a Nigerian, as an African scholar that you are, from your experiences traveling around, do you think Africa has actually, first of all, found its true identity among the Committee of Nations, as to say this is who we are, this is what we stand for? Do you think the AU has actually achieved that for the continent?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Sorry, sometimes some of us, because, you know, we can be a bit evasive, we don't like to give straightforward answers because of the nature of the work we do. Not that, you know, we are deliberate in that.
Okay.
In terms of, if you look at decolonization, in bringing an end to colonialism in Africa, the OAU, you know, was able to use that as the basis to rally Africans, you know, Africans, both in Africa and in the diaspora, and to also as a basis for engagement with the world. So it succeeded in that respect. But beyond that, the sociocultural renewal, sociocultural rediscovery of the continent, which will translate into socioeconomic development, because you cannot lay claim to, you know, identity rests also on something tangible. There is a tangible element to identity, and there is intangibles. So one thing is to say you are a bricklayer. If you don't have the skills, the tools of a bricklayer, people will doubt, people will say, how can you be a bricklayer? So I think the end of decolonization in Africa created a vacuum for mobilizing Africans, for mobilizing Africa. The formation of the AU was an attempt to mobilize Africans around a new agenda, a new identity, anchored on a new development pathway, a new search for solution to Africa's developmental challenges. And I'm not too sure. My instinct is that, and even available data is that, Africa has not fared well in that aspect. So, in essence, in terms of political projects related to decolonization, bringing an end to apartheid and all of that, yes, the AU was able to mobilize Africans, was able to build, an African identity, an African position on that. But since that came to an end, the AU has struggled. That, I think, is one. Two, when we talk about the AU and we talk about Africa, we have to be very careful to talk of it in the singular. Africa is unbelievably diverse. People look at Nigeria and say, wow, Nigeria is very diverse, it's huge and all of that. Just imagine a continent of 54 countries. Each country has only God knows how many number of ethnic groups and different languages or being spoken. So Africa, is incredibly diverse, so we need to be very careful in terms of how we qualify it. We shouldn't speak of Africa, in the singular.
Sorry,
We need
sir,
to acknowledge
if
the
you let me
plurality of
interject a bit, do you think that
it.
diversity is a sort of provides a sort of slight problem in terms of managing the affairs under the unit AU? Do you think the large
No.
ethnicity and diversity is a problem?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, it will be simplistic to simply say because of the diversity, then we can't get things done. No, absolutely no. Actually, there is strength, in that diversity. What Africa has failed to do is to be able to harness that diversity and to be able to also find something that connects, the different groups, the different countries, across the continent. So if, for example, irrespective of our language, irrespective of our religion, irrespective of our different, cultural background and the
Background, yeah.
rest, if the whole of Africa decides to rally around a new vision of development that is based on eradication of poverty and, putting an end to marginalization and exclusion of particular groups. If Africa seeks a new developmental agenda around that, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter what language you speak, it doesn't matter what religion you practice. The key issue is these are the principles that says that be inclusive. Whatever you want to do in any community, adopt an inclusive approach. Bring everybody around the table. Be just. Let fairness and justice be your watchword. The way you manage resources entrusted in your care, the way you manage the affairs of people, the way you manage the affairs of country, you have to apply these principles. It doesn't matter who you are and where you are, just do the right thing.
Okay, moving on, after, like I said, I'm just a bit digressing before we come back to the issues of security and development. Since they have decided to build a new plan for the next 50 years in that Agenda 2063, I know I've gone through the document. The whole plan looks so nice and beautiful. I mean, you pick it and you see hope. You feel good, And then they have divided it into 10 years plans. Okay, the whole thing broken down into 10 years, and since 2013, by 2023, we'll be concluding the first 10 years. Do you think we're actually in the right direction as we speak? at this point. The first 10 years, some of the agenda that they have earmarked to do in the first 10 years, is it in the process, are they taking the right decisions? Can we get that achievement in the 10 years? And if we don't get that, how will it not affect the entire 50-year plan?
Well, my fear about Agenda 2063 is the extent to which it is owned outside of the AU headquarters in Addis. So the extent to which it is owned by individual countries, and the extent to which Africans, the African citizens, African people identify with it. You know, I'm not even sure you do a sampling of Nigerians and ask them how many people know about Agenda 2063. I'll be surprised if 10% of Nigerians know about it or debate about it.
Yeah.
I'll reasonably be surprised. Even that is on the street of Nigeria. Even government officials, those civil servant people who work in government, let's do a survey and see how many of them have heard of Agenda 2063 before now. Even if we go to the National Assembly, our lawmakers, the Senate and the House of Reps. Let's do a survey and see how many people, how many of them have heard or even know what it entails.
Wouldn't that be ridiculous?
It's not ridiculous. We are just stating it, as it is. We are stating the obvious, which is the Agenda 2063 was done. I know there are consultations with civil society groups around the continent and all of that. But for you to have that agenda resonate, more ought to be done, ought to have been done, and could still be done. To now take the agenda 2063, it doesn't belong to the AU. It belongs to individual countries, to every citizens of Africa. And I am not sure people have plugged into it. In fact, it will be interesting to see. I can do some, maybe at some point check and do some research to see, look at the M&E matrix for it, to see how many countries have even integrated vision Agenda 2063 into their yearly budget planning, budget cycle. How many African countries, 54 African countries, how many of them, when they are preparing their annual budget, or even their MTF, their medium-term expenditure framework, or even their development plans, whatever it is they call it, at the national level. How many, both the yearly one and the short, midterm one up to 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
How many of them use Agenda 2063, the goals, the vision, the aspirations, as well as the goals set in Agenda 2063 on the one hand, and the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals on the other hand.
Yeah.
How many of them are the targets they want to achieve every year? How many of them can reasonably say that they are being guided, the choices they are making, the allocation of resources to critical human development sectors like health, like education, like housing? How many of them are following or are doing things that will lead them to achieve the goals as such? No. I have no doubt that we'll be lucky to find half of African countries doing this. So, there are plans, and many plans. The problem here with Africa is not the lack of vision or the lack of a framework. Even if there were no vision Agenda 2063, the SDG is there. Even if there is no SDG, each regional economic corporation, be it ECOWAS, be it EAC, be it SADC, be it ECAS, they have something, a developmental plan plan of action to guide things. The problem has always been at the level of ownership and the level of translating such plans into programmatic action on a systematic basis that would, for every step you take, for everything you budget or you do in a year, it moves you along a path to achieving, the vision.
Yeah.
So my worry is Agenda 2063 might just be another, 1980 Lagos plan of action that was signed with so much fanfare and everything, and not much has come out of it. And, other similar You know, only God knows how many plans of action the EU has signed in the last 20 years. Only God knows how many.
And that's, of course, very, very unfortunate for the African continent. Okay, so let's come back to the issue of insecurity and the state and the people of Africa. Many, you have cited quite that some of these things are ethnic, intercommunal, and all of that, but we still know that some of these violence issues and insecurity problems we've witnessed in African countries come from politics or from the political class. I just recall Nkurunziza, Pierre Nkurunziza, who, as the president of Burundi, some years back refused to step down when he was supposed to. He retouched the constitution and wanted to remain in the office, and that caused a whole lot of problem that led to deaths and deaths in his country. We had such issues in Zimbabwe. We're having such issues in Cameroon here, where Paul Biya doesn't even want to end his tenure. Now, we know that AU, for instance, is in, led by presidents of the different countries, and most of these presidents contribute, if I can use that word, to some of these problems. So how do you think the AU, for instance, is handling the leaders who are part of that bloc or who are part of that leadership structure, who are also somehow responsible for some of these insecurities? How do you think the AU should or have been handling this situation where the people you are to work with somehow engender these problems?
I think, like you say in my native language, in your real language, what what do you call it? To fella Nicola, he used that sign. He said, what I don't pass on the bridge. Things have gone beyond that. It's no longer the business of the AU, because the AU is the AU to the extent that it is a mirror image of its member state.
Okay.
Yeah, the case you mentioned in respect of Nkurunziza, yes, he refused to step down, but Divine Justice meant he has stepped into the mud. He's 6 feet under now, so justice done. You know, nature took his course.
Yeah.
But coming back to when I say that, you know, water don't pass under the bridge, what it means is that in the last 3 years, if you many of the existing databases on peace and security in Africa, that violent, you know, activities in Africa and political disruption, what is consistently clear is that the most, you know, the commonest violent incident in Africa in the last 10 years is protest. Protest and demonstration.
Yeah.
When Fafore Yadema in Togo, when the people decided enough is enough, they've been protesting for 4 years now nonstop, and they're still on it. You look at Burkina Faso, Blaise Compaoré had been in power. When the people felt enough is enough, he ran away, they got him out of power.
Yeah.
You've had similar experience in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt. There was almost the same situation repeating itself in Algeria before, you know, they clamped on it.
Yeah.
You see the protest against Zuma in South Africa.
Yeah.
The rose must fall, fist must, you know, protest. They were the things that made him to be booted out of office.
Yeah.
You saw the protests in Ethiopia that claimed, you know, the former Prime Minister Desalegn. You are also seeing protests, even, you know, the Imam Diko led protests in Mali, and that is a factor in the military coup that has now, you know, cost, you know, President Keita. You know, that has taken him out of the office.
Yeah.
When Yahya Jammeh, you know, when the people feel enough is enough, started to protest. So what I'm saying is, the AU, because of who it was and what, you know, what it does and the principles, the AU is already incapacitated by its own rules. and by the caliber of people who are the ones representing respective African states. The Nkurunziza one, the AU threatened to invoke Article 4H for the first time, which gave the AU the right to override sovereignty and territorial integrity, where there is a threat of crimes against humanity and genocide and war crimes. The AU threatened to invoke that article for the very first time. And Nkurunziza said he will consider the AU, if the AU were to deploy any force in respect of that Article 4H invocation, he will consider that as an act of war, and he will consider it as an act of invasion. The AU had to back down. So that already tells you the limitations of the AU. Yes, people talk about the AU, the African Peace and Security architecture as, you know, the ASF, Africa Standby Force, which is meant to be, you know, a continental kind of ECOMOG for firefighting. But we do joke in some of our meetings that the force is a standby force, so it will be forever be on standby. It is not meant to be used. It's a standby force, so it has to be standby. So it is not meant to be used. Yeah. So the AU doesn't have the tools to hold anybody to account. What instrument does the AU have to enforce any of the resolution or sanctions? It doesn't have the tool. The AU is not a policing body. It can only rely on moral authority and diplomatic legitimacy.
We have seen like the Yahya Jammeh case you mentioned. We saw the response of ECOWAS and the ECOWAS forces and how it helped matters. What I'm trying to say is the ECOWAS bloc seems to have more power in terms of response. Why is it like that?
What was ECOWAS able to do when Abacha was in power in Nigeria?
Maybe they were not that strong.
It was because it was Gambia, a small country that could be taken care of. Do you think, look at the scenario that is playing out in Cote d'Ivoire and the scenario that is playing out in Guinea-Conakry. Do you think the AU or the ECOWAS would threaten force or invasion to be able to force the head of state in those countries not to go for a third term? No. So the Yahya Jammeh one was a outlier. You know, it's an exception to the rule. When we play football, we say, you know, if I used to be a goalkeeper, so when people play some ball to me, there is a way if I want to demonstrate as if I'm making a very a nice catch or dive. See, throw me the ball. I call it let me shine. So the Gambia was a case of let me shine. But beyond that is not, you know, that happened because Buhari was in power, and Buhari was determined to make a statement. He was in power, and you know, Gambia is English speaking. Nigeria had a free ride. Nigeria had the cooperation, you know, of Senegal, because Gambia is practically encased inside Senegal.
Yes.
Gambia is like a tongue in the mouth of Senegal.
Yeah.
You know, Gambia is actually buried. So, you know, Senegal was on board. The other Anglophone countries in West Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ghana, everybody was on board. So, you know, it was very easy to do that in Gambia. So, coming back to what I'm saying is that expecting the AU and ECOWAS to be the ones to challenge these authoritarian dictators or democratic dictators or democratic dictatorships in Africa, because that is what we have. It's not the way to go, because you won't get anything out of that. You cannot challenge this. Absolute power, absolute sovereignty rests with the people, with Africans, with the citizens of each African country. They are the ones that have the real sovereignty, the real power to hold their government, their leaders, their president to account. And it is happening. In the last 10 years, the dominant political activity in Africa is protest. There have been more protests, more arrests, more death, more killings from protests, more than armed conflict in the last 10 years in Africa. So it is now the people have taken, I don't want to say people have taken the laws into their hands. No, the people have realized that absolute power resides with them. And these so-called, you know, democratic dictators do not have absolute power.
Yeah.
And that they can challenge them. So social media, and so the things that have made this possible, one, social media has made it possible for people to mobilize, for people to connect, to network among themselves, for people of like minds, people who have the same interests, people who are interested in holding their leaders to account. It's made it possible for them to network among themselves and to mobilize other citizens.
Yeah.
That's one. Two, Africa's population structure, in which the median age is 20 or below 20 in a number of African states,
yeah,
we have, you know, people, you know, people age 40 or below constitute the core majority, sometimes 60 to 70%
yeah,
of the population in many African countries. And many young people are hooked up to social media. They are tech, you know, they are techies, they are tech-driven, right?
Yeah.
So that advantage of population numbers, the advantage of social mobilization, social media technology as tool of mobilization, and the global discourse of ideas of self-determination, ideas of good governance, ideas of transparency, ideas of accountability, ideas of people's power.
Mm.
That's global discourse. Right? And other young people seeing how other young people in other parts of the world are holding their leaders, you know, to account,
mm,
is creating a domino effect
based on this, the issue of young people in Africa rising up to take their government into account, there are concerns about many of them not being as active as they should be at this point, and there's the issue of young people at this point being afraid to challenge the powers. I remember in Zimbabwe, after the election of Emmerson Mnangagwa, his election against Nelson Chamisa, there was a kind of protest that even led to death or something in Harare. And if you come back here to Nigeria, for instance, we have a revolution now who, when they protest, some of their members are still in court as they are charged for one thing or the other. It does seem like young people currently do more protest on the social media than they do on the streets, you know. How do you that process? Yes.
Yes and no.
Okay.
You see, holding leaders to account is not a single event. It is actually a series of activities over several years or even decades.
Okay.
In fact, there is no end. Neither is it. You know, there is no beginning. There is no end to it. It is forever. You know, it's a lifelong activity, right? Because if you look at the history of Nigeria, the Ali Bongo protests in the 70s, students protesting against military rule in the 80s into the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, and all, you know, it keeps evolving like that. So it is not a single event. It is not until you go on the street and you get the president out of office, you say that you've held people to account. No, you hold people to account every single day.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, if you look through the whole of Africa, the scale of the protest, the frequency of the protest, the number of people involved in the protest, and the kinds of outcomes from the protest, sending out, you know, people out of office, leaders running away, overthrowing leaders and all of that, that has happened in the last 10 years.
Mm.
Has never happened before in the history of Africa.
Okay.
So something is moving. Something is shifting.
Mm.
There is a shift going on. The shifting that is going on is at different pace, is taking different forms, is manifesting in different ways, and is taking different length of time.
Okay.
in different countries, but it is going on. The revolution now, Tewore and all of that, we didn't have that in 1999 when Obasanjo was in office. We didn't even have that when Yar'Adua was in office, but we have it now. Something is moved. Something is moved and it's moving.
Okay.
The ones in Nigeria are not yet where those things, where it has not had the same kind of outcome it has had in Burkina Faso, in Libya, in Tunisia and everything, is because the nature of the protest now, the ones in Nigeria, for example, the ones in Zimbabwe, the arrowheads of the protest themselves either are already complicit, they are not able to rise above narrow parochial objectives, they are not yet able to connect with the daily realities of ordinary young, you know, other, the vast millions of other young people. They are, you know, their narrative do not yet resonate with those ones. Those ones do not yet see them. They don't see Tewore as the one that embodies their aspirations. You, if you are educated, you listen to Tewore, you can be taken in by what he's saying. Oh, this guy is making sense and all of that.
Yeah.
But the guy who is pushing wheelbarrow in the yam market in Zaki Biam in Benue doesn't see Tewore as zero, or doesn't believe in what Tewore is saying, or doesn't even identify with Tewore. The Métis on the street of Bauchi selling tea who doesn't believe in Tewore and what the noise he's making. The Megad in Lagos, who has been the young Malam who has been brought to Lagos, who is 25 and is selling sweet and biscuits on the side of the street in addition to doing security job, doesn't believe in Tewore. Until you connect with those kinds of people, until those people see you, and not even you as a person, but the issues, the vision you articulate, right?
Yeah.
Until those people connect with it, you won't have the kinds of outcome you have in Burkina Faso and the rest. So, in essence, those protests are not about the individuals. It's not about Tewore as a person.
Yeah.
Right? And you see, talk is cheap. The hard work that is required for social mobilization, for building coalitions, for overcoming ethnic, religious sentiment and divides and all of that. The people of Tewore have not yet been able to do that. They want a quick win. Everybody is doing revolutions in some other places. They think they can simply come in and join, you know, and achieve it in Nigeria in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. No! Go and look at the history of protests in Burkina Faso, when they've been protesting before they got the president out. Go and look at the history of, you know, social mobilization in Egypt before they got Mubarak out of office. Just, you know, these things, you have to pay your dues, you have to do the hard work, you have to be selfless, you have to mobilize, you have to rise above, you know, parochial interest, you have to demonstrate something completely different. Many of these guys, individuals, have either been close to politicians in the past, they collected money, some of them, to Raven himself, collects money from some funding organizations in America, so they are even, some of, you know, Some folks in the north would believe that Tewore is being sponsored to destabilize Nigeria because Inosana is the president of Nigeria. So these are the reasons why, and people thinking that Nigeria will just, people think you sleep and wake up and then you have a protest, you know, a revolution now, achieving the aim of getting a president out of office will happen in Nigeria. No, it takes a lot of hard work and it can take several years for you to get to that point.
Dr. Ismail, let's begin to wrap up this show.
Yeah.
I want you to talk a bit about youth power in Africa. Africa has a good, an enviable human resource advantage, or seem to have, over other continents. And when we talk conflicts, insecurities, we are talking about young people here. Now, how do you think the AU through its various programs and the various structures it has, is projecting or channeling the youth power it has into more productive things, you know, things like education and all of that things. How do you think the African continent has been trying to engage and channel the youth population and power that they have into more productive things so that this issue of insecurity can begin to be abated or reduced in the near future?
I even challenge the premise of your question that it's because the energies of these young people are not being channeled. That's why, you know, we are having peace and security challenges. The youth are not the problems of the continent. In fact, young people are the solution.
Okay.
Young people are the solution. And young people do not wait, are not waiting for the AU or African government or anybody to come and solve their problems for themselves. They are solving the problems by themselves for themselves, using the little resources, using their creativity, using their, you know, their energies, using their God-given talent to, you know, look at the amount of young people the continent has. Africa has a population of 1.2 something billion people.
Mm.
At least young people in Africa constitute about 700 to 800 million out of that, about 840 million actually. Out of that, you know, population. So you think the 840 million are waiting for the AU or their respective president to come and, you know, how many jobs are they going to create for them? How many jobs are they going to create for them? Can Africa create a job for 840 million people?
But can't
they? I
mean,
these are statistical reality. They cannot.
Okay.
It's not possible. It's not possible.
So what is the way forward
India
now for the young people?
Okay, look at the way India and China, two countries that have more population than Africa, or thereabouts, slightly more than Africa, right? What is it they've done? Those two countries are, you know, development-wise, they are the, you know, they've been on the upward trajectory in the last 25, 30 years.
Mm.
Right? What have they done right? The first thing they've done right is investment in human development, education, technical skills, education. Having the average young person to be educated to a point that if that young person will have the skills good enough to operate within and outside of those countries. Why is it that India has the highest number of ICT professionals all over the world, and they export them all over the world? Indian diasporas who are into ICT are all over the world. Look at just investing in technical education. Look at what it meant for them. You know how much India receives in remittances every year? Go and check. India makes more money from remittances than selling of crude oil that Nigeria or African country, natural resources, whatever African resources are, you know, are making from selling natural resources.
Wow.
So that is so I'm just giving you practical examples of the way forward.
Yeah.
So the first one is human development, basic education, primary, secondary, or perhaps, you know, a diploma after secondary, maybe, you know, a diploma or even first degree, whatever it is. Let each African country determine where it wants to peg, you know, the level of human development in terms of education that fit into its own development roadmap. Let each country, it will be different for different countries depending on that country's development context and structure of the, you know, the economic fundamentals for that country.
Yeah.
So the first one is human development, especially on education. The second point is the global economy is changing. Africa cannot, except there is something that blows everybody away over the next 10 to 20 years. The population growth projection for Africa is 1.2 billion now. By the end of this century, Africa will be about 4.4 billion. So the population of Africa is going to multiply by 3 times. It's going to increase by over 300% by the end of this century. Right?
Yeah.
So where I'm going is that the economy of Africa cannot absorb the number of young people it currently has, and even the ones that are coming over the next 20, 30, 40 years, 50 years. So Africa's development thinking and development planning must be done in the global context. Why can't Africa copy India and say, we want to be the one to be exporting technical engineers and manufacturing all over the world? It is already happening. Canada, US, Australia, New Zealand, they have all manner of visa, visa lottery, ILIS, skill visa. They are trying to attract the best skills, the best people with manpower that will support their economy. If you look at the global population trajectory, many Western countries are going to be depopulated. Their population, you know, will drop over the next 50 years. They are going to need manpower. They are going to need population. They are going to need people to man their economy, to keep their economy powering. Africa needs to be looking at that. That the place to be is the world for young people in Africa. It's no longer Africa anymore. So Africa must prepare its citizens, its young people, to take the world by a storm, to be hired by the world, to be useful to the world, for the young people to go out there and work in any part of the world and, you know, bring money back. People talk about brain drain. Now it has to be about brain gain.
Okay.
It has to now be an economic or development mode as part of Africa's development model. It has to be included into that. We have, that is the biggest natural resource Africa has. People, it's young population. So it is not the, what can the AU do to make them, they are not the cause of the conflict in Africa. And if you create jobs, you're thinking, how many jobs can government create? Which government in the whole of Africa has created 5 million jobs or 10 million jobs? Let's talk less of creating jobs for 840, 850 million young people in the country. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Yes, it does.
The premise is, these young people are not the cause of problems of conflict in Africa. That it's been proven.
Let us bring it to a wrap, Dr. Ismail. On the final note, how would you rate the AU and its implementations of programs and whatever it wants to do in Africa as compared to other continental blocs like the EU, for instance, the Asian body? How would you rate AU's performances and what they plan to do alongside them?
You see, it's very easy to bash the AU and say the AU is not doing well and is not doing this, is not doing that. But that is besides the point. The real issue is that the AU is not set up as an implementing body, as an executing body.
Okay.
The AU is set up as an agenda setting, as a coordination mechanism. It's set up to set agenda to help to develop like Vision 2063, and to coordinate activities among countries or RECs and all of that.
Okay.
And in that instance, you can say the AU is not doing too badly. It's doing reasonably well. Of course, it can do better.
Okay.
But it's doing reasonably okay. The problem of implementation and getting things done is not the bread and butter of the AU. It's not even the bread and butter of the ECOWAS.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ismail, for talking.
Good morning, my neighbor. How are you doing? Are you feeling okay? Good morning, my neighbor. How are you doing? Are you feeling okay?